This is Wins and Losses with Clay Travis. Clay talks with the most entertaining people in sports, entertainment, and business. Now, here's Clay Travis.
Welcome in, Wins and Losses podcast. I'm your fearless host, Clay Travis. I hope you guys have been enjoying the podcast so far. We have got a bevy of them. If this is the first that you have listened to, go back through. It's summer. There's lots of opportunity to kill time. Maybe you're sitting at the beach. Maybe you're at a pool. Need something good to listen to. Want to drive while you got the kids in the back. Hopefully this can be a show that entertains you at least a little bit. And what we're doing here is exploring the wins and losses of a career through the prism of sports, media, politics, and business. And we got a guy who is pretty familiar with a lot of those areas, Dave Finocchio. He's one of the original co-founders of Bleacher Report. And we are going to get into that here momentarily. But first of all, Dave, thanks for coming on with us.
Thanks for having me, Clay.
You're here in Nashville getting ready for a triathlon, right?
Yeah, first triathlon I'm doing with a buddy tomorrow morning. So there will either be a win or a loss around that as well. We'll
see. How confident are you on the triathlon? What are you most nervous about? What particular aspect of it?
The swim, for sure. Yeah, I'm pretty solid, like, mentally on the bike and the run.
Yeah.
But yeah, if I don't drown, I think I'll be okay.
All right. So a lot of people, I'm sure, who are listening to us are familiar with what the Bleacher Report does now. But what I bet they're not very familiar with is how Bleacher Report became what it became. So let's go back in time. Let's go first into your background. Where are you from? Where'd you grow up? All of those things.
Yeah, I grew up in a suburb of San Jose, California. So Northern California, West Coast. Went to high school out there and ended up at Notre Dame in South Bend, Indiana. I've always been like a huge sports junkie my entire life. Like, went and visited that place, and the hairs on my arm stood up, and I just wanted to go to school there so badly. So that,
I bet you didn't visit in the middle of the winter.
No, I was one of those like classic trap trips where like had like 70 degree weather in April. Had like the perfect tour guide. It was like all the wrong things lined up right
Was that a huge culture shock for you, the winter, the first year you were there, coming from Northern California?
The winter was a shock, and also I'm not Catholic. I didn't grow up going to a Catholic school or anything. So just like that aspect of it, how religious Notre Dame is, combined with going, like, it was the first time I'd spent a lot of time with kids like from small towns in the Midwest. And it was great for me because I learned how to relate to all sorts of different people with different backgrounds and stuff that like seemed pretty foreign to me.
Yeah.
But yeah, the first year was a super weird experience coming from California.
I kind of had the same experience. I went away to college in Washington, D.C., and I grew up in Nashville, where we're doing this interview now. But it was a huge departure for me to suddenly be on the East Coast and be surrounded by East Coast kids. There were very few people similar to what I had grown up with in Nashville.
Right.
And it was a total culture shock, but I think it toughened me up.
Totally.
Because if I had spent my entire life in the South, I came back to law school at Vanderbilt. I feel like I wouldn't have been as tough, just in terms of the way people behave and kind of that East Coast mindset, which I think really kind of suffuses media in general. It definitely made me more prepared for what I ended up doing for a living without even realizing that was happening. And I bet for you, on some level, going to Notre Dame was important for what you would end up doing as well.
Yeah, I ended up going to Chicago after school. I did one of those classic, like, was dating a girl in college and kind of followed her there. I ended up, like, when I was finishing up college, I started thinking about what Bleacher Report ended up becoming. You're like...
So how? Let me stop you right here. How old are you?
I'm 36. I just turned 36.
So you just turned 36. So when you're in college, what was your experience like with the internet? Because what I tell people is, when I got to college, I'd never had an email before.
Right.
I just turned 40, right? So I'm 4 years older than you. They gave me an email address. I was like, I was familiar. It's like I was not familiar with the internet, but we didn't have the internet at home.
Yeah, your life didn't revolve around it yet.
Did not revolve around it in any way. And even when you got the email address, you would have to go to the computer lab on campus to get on the internet. And I remember my freshman year, you were talking about how you liked sports. I was obsessed with sports. And for people, I bet you saw this too, when you suddenly went to Notre Dame, I don't know what teams did you grow up a fan of in Northern California?
Bay Area teams, Giants, 49ers, Warriors are like my big three teams.
So I bet you found that it was a little bit hard to follow those teams when you got into Notre Dame because
totally.
It was such a regional sports universe. I'm a big SEC football fan. And so I kind of gravitated to the web because I remember the Chattanooga Times Free Press was the first one to get online. But when I started in D.C., I would intern in the congressman's office, and they would mail the newspaper.
Yeah.
And, like, I was so starved for local sports news that I would read multi-day-old newspapers to try to keep tabs on what my favorite team was doing.
Yeah, and what young people don't remember now, because maybe they just missed it, was, you know, the alternative sports center, and you maybe had to wait 40 minutes for your team's highlight.
To 2 minutes.
Right. So that wasn't a great user experience either.
Or you would sit and watch the ticker at the bottom of the screen to see score updates,
yeah.
Right? I mean, which now seems totally foreign to anybody, but you might have to wait 10 minutes between, you know, you happen to catch it coming across the bottom, and then you wait, and then suddenly it's changed a great deal. So,
So I got you on that. So, like, my generation, or, you know, I'm just 4 years later than you, but our culture on school, like, revolved a lot around, you know, you've got a desktop computer, a laptop that's sitting in your apartment or your dorm room or whatever, and, like, everybody's on AOL Instant Messenger.
Oh, yeah.
So it's, like, social life revolved around that versus Facebook.
Yes.
Facebook came out maybe, like, my junior year of college, but it wasn't a big, like, our lives didn't revolve around it yet. So there's that, and then I just found, like, I finished up my majors a little bit early in college. It's cold as hell, second semester, my senior year. And I was just, like, doing what you were doing. I was surfing the web a lot looking for sports content.
Yeah.
And that was when I started to have these observations around, one, like, I had this broad observation around, I just thought my generation was kind of stuck with, like, our dad and grandfather's sports websites.
Yes.
I just thought, like, the voices were old. A lot of the sports writers were older. I bet in retrospect, their content probably didn't perform that well. It was, like, very wordy. Like, content you wouldn't necessarily share with your friends. It wouldn't start a discussion. So that was one thing. It was like, this content's old. It's not, like, shareable, snackable. It's not video content the way there is today. And then the other thing is, I was an economics major in college, and I just kept coming back to this, like, this premise that I thought there were pretty big supply and demand inefficiencies around sports content. Like, the best example that I can think of is, you know, this is 2005. Every outlet in the country, whether national or regional, is still, like, physically sending a reporter to the Major League Baseball All-Star Game, like paying for hotel rooms,
yes,
flights. And the Major League Baseball All-Star Game was a huge deal in this country in the 60s, the 70s, even the 80s. By 2005, it's not something that is, like, a premium event from an interest standpoint. But then you have these other super high interest events, like the NFL Draft, that you guys did an amazing job with here this year, and certain NBA transaction windows. We just saw NBA free agency, all these things that weren't necessarily TV events first. And then certain teams like the Red Sox and the Yankees, great coverage. The Golden State Warriors at the time,
couldn't find anything.
Not a lot, right? So it seemed like if you just explored these different kind of markets for content, you could find pockets where you could do stuff that would perform really well.
So you have that kind of thesis percolating in your mind when you're at Notre Dame. You're an economics student.
It's
the final semester of your college. You move to Chicago. What happens then? You're probably around 22 years old, like a lot of 22-year-olds, probably a lot of people who are listening to this are either college grads, in college, soon-to-be college grads.
Totally.
Trying to figure out exactly what their pathway is.
Yeah.
What comes next when you graduate?
Yeah, so I took a finance job. I did finance internships in college, and, you know, I kind of had this, like, feeling in the back of my mind when I was figuring out what I was going to do that it didn't sit right with me to just do the same thing that everybody else was doing.
Yeah.
I, like, did these internships and was with all these guys, like, who grinded out 80 hours a week, and it seemed like their relationships with their wives at home maybe sometimes weren't that good, and all, like, the very cliche things that you hear. And I'm just like, I don't want this to be my life. I want to do something that's, like...
So you're starting to have, like, a quarter-life crisis.
Totally. It just felt like it just didn't sit well with me that I was kind of getting on that type of path.
Yes.
But I did it anyway to start making some cash. But before I actually started the job, on, like, 4th of July of 2005, I kind of had a, hey, screw it. I want to do this sports thing. Like, for real, I want to do it. I made a PowerPoint presentation the next morning. I sent it to, like, 8 of my friends who I thought kind of had their, I don't know if we can swear or not, had their shit together at that point. You know,
yeah,
with 22, you have friends who are smart, but maybe you're not, like, totally put together at that
yes.
point. So I sent it to guys who I thought might actually, like,
these are
do
friends
work.
From college or friends from high school? How do you know these
both.
Guys?
Yeah. Like, high school friends, college friends. And the first response I got back was from my buddy Brian Goldberg, who ended up being one of my co-founders. And he and I made a documentary together At the end of high school, we made like an hour-long documentary. So it was kind of like, okay, like...
What was the documentary about?
We did a trip to Europe with like a group of buddies and we...
So it was like Spider-Man Far From Home?
Yeah,
I know this because I've got kids. Like I'm sitting around... I've seen Spider-Man Far From Home 3 times in the theaters already.
Yeah, it was more like the drama that was created after like long drinking nights and people's
so
feelings
where
getting hurt.
Where did you go? Like how many guys did you go to Europe with?
It was like 12 guys. We did London, Amsterdam, Munich... Berlin, Barcelona, something like
How
that.
How long were you gone?
A month.
Oh, that's phenomenal.
Yeah, it was really good.
Yeah, so you just had like a handheld camera at the time?
Yeah, we just decided going into it that it'd be a project that we'd all do is like, let's take a bunch of footage and see what happens. And
did
then
you do like testimonials, like real world style where people
sit and talk
and
totally.
Everything else?
Yeah, and we had great drama. Like I stole a buddy's ticket to Wimbledon and then he kicked my ass afterwards the next morning, which is like all on film. So we had like...
When's
like,
the last time you watched the film?
Probably like 15 years ago.
So what would happen if the film got out today? Would it be scandalous?
I don't know, like Brian's probably better known than I am in media circles these days. But yeah, my guess is it wouldn't be like a perfect thing for him.
No, it's interesting. Like,
maybe somebody should probably leak it. I'm not going to do it.
We did something similar. We weren't gone for a month, but I'm 4 years older than you. It's probably around the same time. Law school. When we finished law school, we went to Europe and we had like a buddy who was like to take shots of everything. And there's tons of footage, right, of us. I mean, there's probably about 12 guys. And we went to Spain during spring break. It was during our last year of law school.
Spain's a great time.
Yeah, it was like our last hurrah. We stayed in Sevilla. We stayed in Madrid. We had an incredible time. But we all knew that we were about to hit the grind of practicing law full time. And so it's like an abrupt stop to suddenly being – having a great life, honestly, because law school, if you get into a decent law school, your grades don't really matter that much,
yeah,
you know, because they don't want to flunk you out because then you can't get a job. So you're going to graduate and probably you'll be able to get a pretty good job. And so, but we all knew that like we were going to go from our life is awesome to like hitting a brick wall full speed, right?
Yeah.
Now, the positive is you get more money. The negative is you have no fun because you're just, you're stuck in an office grinding away 80 hours a week all of a sudden. So anyway, I'm sympathetic to that. So you did that, and he was on the video and everything else, and he was one of your co-founders. And he says immediately when you send out this plan for what would become Bleacher Report, I love it.
Yeah, Brian was just in right away. And one of the other things I liked about working with him is so he has a cousin, this guy named Jake Lodwick, who was one of the co-founders of College Humor.
Okay.
So this is like when I was in college, College Humor
For people out there who don't know, College Humor was massive. And really what they did was they would link all sorts of craziness that would go on college campuses, basically. Right?
Yeah, totally.
And they were like Wake Forest grads, right, who initially started that, if I'm not mistaken.
I forget where Ricky and
does that site still exist?
Yeah, it still exists. IAC owns it, Barry Diller.
And they did they did very well with it for years, right?
Yeah, they did. They sold it. They all made money.
Yeah.
So basically, like, in Brian's family, there was this actual case study of, like holy shit, you have
this
a cousin who started a media company?
Yes.
He's like, this is – because everybody we talked to, like, our parents maybe his parents were a little bit better, like, investors in Silicon Valley, everybody at the time, like
– You tried to make pitches.
We tried – we initially did pitches, and the gist we got back was, like, guys, content businesses, media companies like this don't work.
Even back in like – this would have been 2005.
This was before media companies got hot. There ended up
being
a window.
Before they got hot and before they died, right? I mean,
that's right
now people are saying there's no opportunity in media.
That's exactly right. There ended up being – because of – not to jump ahead, but because of the success of Huffington Post,
yes,
because of the success of Bleacher Report, because Facebook started pushing media company content for – like a 3 or 4 year period.
BuzzFeed, for all the people out there who are
totally
listening, like there was an entire incubated period. They were not hot, then they got hot, now they're not hot again.
Yeah. So we were on the front end of that where we had to beat on like the number of pitches I did and just like slogged. It was such a good experience learning how to sell ourselves and stuff like that. But initially like all the help we could get and having at least a connection point to somebody who'd done it before for me felt like, okay, you know, great.
So you're still working full time while you're trying to pitch this new venture that you have? Or
I was working full time while we were just trying to get a website off the ground. So
yeah,
we did. So I ended up having this finance job for 20 months in Chicago. We got Bleacher Report off the ground by I think like March of 2006 was when we first launched a website. And I literally and Brian, too, and Dave, the other guy who co-founder who came on. I mean, I was emailing bloggers. Like, at the time, the blogosphere was a big deal. You had all of these people who were writing for free anyway. You asked about the early beginnings of Bleacher Report. I tried as much as possible to sell people on the notion of, like, look, we're going to build a meritocracy for sports writing. We're going to help you reach way more fans than you could ever reach on your own, which ended up being true times 100.
Yeah.
We got people in front of millions of readers. And it was like, look, the best stuff will rise to the top and the other stuff will sink to the bottom. One of the things that didn't end up being the case is, like, because of Google News and because of these different distribution sources that would emerge, sometimes if we had stories or content that wasn't very good, somebody would pick it out and say, like, look at this shit story on Bleacher Report. And we got our brand took a lot of body blows I feel like I've spent the last 5 years kind of working to overcome a lot of the early hits that we took, but I kind of have no regrets because I think it was kind of impossible to build our business in that era of media any other way.
Be sure to catch live editions of Outkick, the coverage with Clay Travis, weekdays at 6 a.m. Eastern, 3 a.m. Pacific.
So let's go back. How did you pick the name Bleacher Report?
Brian came up with the name. I hate coming up with names. We did like a name brainstorm on the... Like, we did literally, like, hundreds and hundreds of phone calls those first 20 months when we were doing it part-time. And one of them, like, over a few weeks was, all right, guys, we got to come up with a name. And it was just, like, this pretty literal take on, you know, sports, bleachers, baseball, like, report, Drudge Report.
It was, yeah.
I never thought it was the best name or the most original name. We actually, our first big investors tried really hard to get us to change the name. I think they went behind our backs.
What did they want you to change it to?
They just wanted us to hire like a third-party firm to come up with another name for us. And because a lot of like Bleacher Report, a lot of people get confused at the two R's and are like, Bleach Report?
Yeah.
So until it, like any brand, if it's around long enough, it becomes a brand. I don't think it was like the greatest name of all time.
So we're talking to Dave Finocchio, who is one of the co-founders of the Bleacher Report. You said you launched in March of...
I think when we first had a website up, I think it was March of 2006.
How much money did you raise, or what was the cost to get your website up?
Do you remember
what you were in for?
Almost like initially probably like 10 or 15 grand, something like that. Super cheap. We, the three of us, Brian, Dave, and I saved up money. Dave was working for Endeavor in LA. Brian was doing consulting for Deloitte, and I was doing private equity stuff. I think we all saved maybe 20 or 30 grand each.
Yep.
And then once we had that, we quit our jobs, moved back to the Bay Area, opened up like a 300 square foot windowless, air conditioningless office in like a child psych, like we're in like a weird situation.
How did you find the place to be located?
I think Dave Nemitz found it. I just remember moving home and he'd lined up an office. It was the right price. You know,
do you remember what you paid?
I think it was like $600 a month.
Yeah.
Which in the Bay Area at the time was pretty cheap.
Yeah. So you're in the Bay Area at the time. Where do you move back? Do you move back in with your parents?
Yeah, like, I moved back in with my parents. Like I was, you know, I went to college.
Young.
I was on my own in an apartment in Chicago living a decent life for
a lot of people would consider to be on the path to success, right? Like
totally.
You've got a great job. You're working in private equity.
Yeah.
You're in Chicago, which is the capital of the Midwest. If you're from Notre Dame, you probably had a lot of college friends who were in the area.
Yeah. Totally.
Probably a pretty good social life. And then you just say, this is not for me. I'm going to go start my own internet sports website.
Yeah. And all my friends,
made fun of me.
Yeah, they all made fun of me behind my back and stuff. Some to my face, which was fine too. But yeah, I ended up moving back in with my parents for, I think, 15 months.
Yep.
Something like that.
Into your old bedroom?
They had moved. They moved when I was in college.
Okay.
So like had a different setup. So at least there was I didn't have to deal with that shame. but grinded through that. I think, you know, and that my girlfriend broke up with me like in that phase too. So I went from feeling like I had a pretty good,
you're
not the coolest guy in the world, but like I've got a decent life
in Chicago with your own apartment to living in your parents' home, home. Were you in the basement as the cliche would be?
Close enough. Yeah.
In your parents' home, $600, $700 a month place in San Francisco, starting your own sports website.
Yeah. Initially we were actually, down in like the Menlo Park area, literally like two blocks from our high school.
Oh,
I'm the group that ended up doing this full time were three of my high school buddies.
What high school did you go to?
We went to this school called Menlo.
Okay. Is that a private school in the Bay Area?
Yeah, it's a private school.
And you've known the guys that you started Bleacher Report with for how long?
I grew up with Dave, so I've probably known him since I was 6 years old or something. I've known Brian and Xander, the other guy who joined early, since we were 12, maybe.
Okay, so, and all of you huge sports fans growing up?
Yeah, I would say Xander, Dave, and I were huge sports fans. Brian was a sports fan.
Yeah.
But maybe not on the same level as the other three of us.
Okay, so you guys are doing what on a day-to-day basis? Like you show up, you've got this office, you got this website. Do you remember the first article or articles that you put up?
Yeah. In the first year, I think I wrote 50 articles. So in the beginning, a lot of it was us and other friends I brought on to help full-time, some people that I recruited a couple hundred writers. But I think the first article I wrote was about how the NBA undervalues defensive players.
Yes.
I think that's the first article that was ever written for Bleacher Report.
And what kind of traffic would that – do you remember what kind of audience that article would have gotten?
So you asked what we initially did. So on the one side, so Brian was kind of managing we had gotten a website up, but it was super basic. And
yes.
It didn't – the back end of the website. Like today, you can buy off-the-shelf CMS software where you can kind of manage a website. It's not that hard to do. Back then, you couldn't really do that. The CMSs were extremely limited, so we had to build all of our own tech stack. So he, for the most part, was managing that, where it was like, okay, we're going to raise money and we're going to launch something that's bigger and better where we can scale. At that point, I was focused on raising the money and I was focused on building an editorial process and an audience. So I figured out stuff like what you asked, which was like, okay, what topics are going to produce the most traffic? Why, when, everything about essentially marketing content. So initially I figured out like, geez, every time we write a story about the NFL draft, it does a hell of a lot better than when we write a baseball story.
Yeah.
And then you start there and then it turns out you can get like incredibly sophisticated about that down to really at the time when Google had more info available than they have today, you could look up any keyword on earth. Like NFL draft order was one I always talk about where we figured out that on the last day of the NFL regular season, there were a couple million people that would search for the term NFL draft order.
Your season's over and you're already thinking like, where are we going to be able to draft?
Totally. So you're like a Raiders fan back in that era and you have the first pick and it's like, you know, should we take Jamarcus or who's going to, hope springs eternal, right? That notion. So maybe ESPN starts their NFL draft coverage in earnest in like February, March, leading up to the TV event. We figured out that, hey, on that last day of the season, we need to have the draft package for every single team because fans want this content now. And that's an example of the type of inefficiency I referenced earlier.
So you, and I love this, you basically looked at it as a sports fan, but also as an economics major from Notre Dame at the internet and said, hey, we can see that there are tons of people who are out there looking for something simple like what is the draft order? And that audience is not being serviced.
Exactly.
And so early on, and I know about this because I've been writing on the internet for a long time, and unlike a lot of other writers, I got into the data behind what people clicked on at a much earlier age than a lot of other writers did, I think. You know, because maybe because I was 25 years old and I was more tech savvy.
Not to when you were at FanHouse, so I happened to hire a guy who worked in analytics at FanHouse, and I won't out him, but I remember him saying because there were some well known writers that were at FanHouse, and I'm sure when
they
you started
spent a
there,
lot of money on on newspaper columnists with the idea being that their audience would follow them online. They spent hundreds of thousands.
But you were the highest performing writer there by a good margin. I remember him either telling me or showing me something, and that was it. Kind of made sense once we went back and looked at your repository of content. It was like, all right, this guy knows what he's doing relative to these others who are writing about topics that are not necessarily connective to what their audience is interested in now.
Yes. No, I mean, that's 100% right. I mean, I think to the extent that I had an early advantage in writing, it was that I knew what people wanted to read.
Yeah.
Right? And I think a lot of writers write what they want to write.
They write for their own peer group.
Which is a tiny little subset of the overall audience. And so you end up writing articles that aren't very well read. And so I was always like, okay, you know, and I think it works for radio sensibilities too, because I've got to talk every day about the three or four most popular things that are going on in the world of sports or otherwise, right? And for better or worse, I'm pretty good at figuring out what people are going to care about. And I'm also naturally there, right? Like I always say, I have like very middle of the road taste and interest. And so I think I hit a large swath just by nature. But I'm fascinated by you going in. So you write these articles and you start to look at the data. Initially, it's a pre-social media era, right? So there's no Facebook, there's no Twitter. When you guys launched, Google is the primary driver of your audience, or how are people finding you?
Yeah, so let's say 2007, where we're really focused on this, through honestly, like through 2012, 2013, everything's kind of driven off of Google. Facebook didn't really start pushing publisher content until 2013.
Yeah.
So there's this big wave. And what we did really well is you have a team of writers who are creating content and it goes on Google, Google News, and you have readers come back to articles on a website, right? Most websites, basically those readers might be on the article for 30 seconds, a minute. If it's a really good article, 5 minutes. One of the reasons we did so many slideshows is people stay on slideshows way longer than they stay on your average article. So I'm sorry to everyone who that bothered, but just from a pure business standpoint, we were always accused of like, oh, they're doing it for the page views. And you do a little bit, but the numbers just didn't lie. So anyway,
People say they hate slideshows, but yeah. The results actually showed you that they will at least sit there and continue.
Engagement on slideshows is way, way higher than it is on standard articles, unless the article is exceptional.
It reminds me, it's fascinating, because when I was at Fan House, you were mentioning people would all say, this was in the early age of when people would send emails and stuff. They're like, why are you covering Brett Favre? Like, and will he or won't he retire? And the minute that a Brett Favre update went in, there's like a fire hose, right, of traffic. Everybody says, oh, I don't care about Brett Favre or Tim Tebow or LeBron James or whatever it is. But I always say it's like the internet data is like you can pull back their brain and see what they actually care about as opposed to what they say they care about.
Yeah.
And that's a great example.
You can listen to a vocal minority if you want and try to please those people. And as we've gotten bigger, we've had to do more of that, I think, for brand reasons. But if you're just trying to focus on surviving and building a business that's going to be around, then I think you need to look at data and do and balance more what the data is.
Yeah.
Not like suggesting you should do is slapping you in the face and saying, hey, like if you want to make it to the next level and for this company to be around in 3 or 4 years, do more of this. But on Google, the thing we did, I think, really well is opposed to just letting those people bounce in and out. We said, okay, this is actually an opportunity to convert these people who are essentially passerby readers into loyal users. And the first thing we did where I started to feel like Bleacher Report might actually work is we launched newsletters.
Yeah.
For basically every single big team in the U.S., the college football newsletters, SEC newsletters were the craziest. Where we had Bama, LSU, Auburn newsletter lists that had 20,000 people on them. That in season we're getting open rates of close to 70%.
Which is a sign of the affinity that people have for their teams.
So, I mean, the voracious appetite of fans around those particular teams in the United States, there's nothing else like it, right? They're at the very top of the food chain. But all of a sudden we had people, because of these newsletters, which we'd send out 3 or 4 times a week, we'd send out our own content, but we would also round up the best content. Like we would curate the best content from around the web so they wouldn't have to find it themselves. Again, this is before Facebook.
Yes.
It's before people are really using Twitter. So it was a nice service we were offering them. And all of a sudden, like we had this loyal audience of 1 million people, 2 million people, 3 million people, in addition to the, 10 million people that were kind of coming and bouncing out every month. And that was real. All of a sudden, people had a positive affinity for our brand, or at least those people did. And then when mobile apps happened in a more sophisticated way, like the App Store with Apple, we basically turned those newsletters into a real-time app product. And our app just exploded. And that was when I think Bleacher Report like was a thing where...
Fox Sports Radio has the best sports talk lineup in the nation. Catch all of our shows at foxsportsradio.com. And within the iHeartRadio app, search FSR to listen live.
Talking to Dave Finocchio, one of the co-founders of Bleacher Report. All right, I want to go back. So you write the first article.
Yeah.
And you said like 50 articles to begin with.
Yeah.
When did you start thinking, hey, maybe this business might actually work? Was there like everybody who ever starts anything new, there is the hope and then there's early signs that can be success or failure. You have to push through it. First of all, how many hours are you working with the other guys when you guys first start this business?
Like a shitload.
Yeah. Like you guys would come into the office and, I mean, basically working full time. Like, what are you doing?
I would say it was just my life.
Yeah.
There were days where I literally would start working, not every day, but weeks where I would just start working at 7 a.m. and stop working at midnight just because I don't mean to be overdramatic about it, but it's true, because I like knew that I needed to get sleep.
Yeah.
And it was just like, because I was, we had no professional editorial team. I was just literally emailing assignments to, you know, dozens, if not hundreds of writers at times, dealing with correspondence back and forth.
And you found those writers just by going on the internet and just kind of jumping around?
Initially, yeah. I recruited people off of blogs, college newspaper writers. I did something that was probably not great for quality of content, sports content on the internet, but helped us grow. So judge away. But when Facebook ads came out, which was, I want to say, like late 2007, initially they performed really, really poorly relative to Google. And as a result, they were super cheap.
Yeah.
Advertisers were just like they were like banner ads on the side of Facebook, not in newsfeed the way they are today. But because they were cheap and because you could target, I had teams to fill out in terms of like, I don't have people covering, you know, the National Predators, if they were around, like whoever it was. So I could target for the first time English majors, journalism majors who had an affinity for the National Predators, and I could start building writer leads, and I could then send, you know, if somebody then clicked through and signed up and said, yeah, sure, I'll cover this team for you. I could then send them an assignment right away and say, okay, I'll give you a go. I'm interested in this story.
Yep.
Why don't you get this to me by 8 p.m. on Wednesday?
And how did you decide what that story would be? Like, so let's say National Predators, for example. You're trying to find somebody to write about them. You're running a Facebook ad. Is it a Google search that would give you an idea what people might be searching for? Or
I'd say a combination of data and just like I've been a sports junkie my whole life. So it's part art, part science.
Yeah.
There might have been a I don't know the Predators that well, but so I won't have a good like real example. But there might have been some sort of
recent free agent move, recent trade or whatever that you would have been cognizant of.
Totally.
Yeah.
Anything along those lines that like fit the mold of a type of story I knew that people would be interested in. And then I would see if the writer was one, reliable, accountable, and then, you know, if they were any good. And I think we basically had all this data, right? And we were able to tap into this huge supply of writers who ended up signing up. And our story and the quality of the content was really mixed, right? Everything from pretty good to shitty. But the way our business worked over time is once we were able to raise more money and once our audience started to get big enough where we could sell advertising, I was able to just over time replace the writers who were not up to a certain quality with professional people. And it took me about 3 years to complete that transition, and it was hard. And it took the brand years longer to recover from it. But it worked.
Yeah. So when do you guys, so you're working, you know, sometimes basically all day except for sleeping hours.
Yeah.
When do you,
in the extreme, sure.
Yeah. When do you start thinking, hey, maybe we've got a business here? When do you guys start taking salary? Like, because, you know, you said you started it with, you know, basically you saved up $20,000 or $30,000 each. When does it become possible that you can start to make money off of the website?
So, like in late 2007, we raised $1.5 million, and that was like one of the best feelings I ever had when we got that raise. So it was like, ha, like my friends can't make fun of me anymore. This is real. Like we
so
can
you
open
raise
up
a million
office.
And a half. That's like a year and change into the existence of the company.
Yeah.
So what? There's probably people out there listening. I actually don't know that much in specific about venture capital.
Yeah.
So when you sell, I mean, a lot of people watch Shark Tank and everything else. You raise $1.5 million.
Yeah.
What kind of equity are you selling at that point?
Yeah, we sold about 30% of our company. So we were nobodies, you know, it's not like we were like Bill Simmons or somebody. So we sold 30% of our company for $1.5 million. It was a big chunk up front, but nobody else would do it. Like we literally found one investor.
Find that investor?
It was a guy that my co-founder, Brian's dad, I think went to business school with. They were these two guys who'd co-founded a company called Ariba that had a $40 billion market cap before like the .com crash.
Yeah.
And they happened to, I think they had a falling out with the CEO or something, and they left the company and they sold at the right time. And they just made an unbelievable amount of money.
And they had tons of money that they just
tons
used
of money.
As seed capital in the Bay Area to kind of get.
That's exactly
companies.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Bay Area and Israel, I think, are where they primarily make their investments. So we got hooked up with those guys. But to your point, like you asked when I thought it was going to work between 2007 and 2010, I mean, there were some serious ups and downs. Like there were, we hired an initial CEO that those investors kind of forced on us that didn't work out. And we had a hard time kind of figuring out that transition of how things were going to go forward, not having the right CEO on board. And I bought GMAT books. I was taking GMAT practice.
Like you thought the company might just...
Yeah. So I was totally on the fence. I went to bed so many nights, not thinking, but knowing it wasn't going to work. You know, in your gut, where like, I'm doing this, but this is not going to work.
Right.
Our audience got stuck at like 2 to 3 million people. We were focused on the wrong things. And I was there like totally in the dumps. And, the best thing that ever happened to us was when we went through, like, honestly, a pretty ugly transition kind of away from the person who was the CEO. The three of us who were the three original founders really pulled together, and we kind of divided up our responsibilities in a more clear way than we ever had before. And in like a 6-month span, we took our audience from 3 million monthly readers to 10 million. And that was honestly like one of my favorite memories of all the things we've done, was that 6-month period.
And that would have been what years?
That was like end of 2009 through the first 6 months of 2010.
So like 3 or 4 years into the company's life cycle.
Yeah. And once we got to the end of that and we started hiring, that gave us the ability to start hiring more professional people who'd been there, done that before. Like, it got us over the hump with investors, with everyone, where they're like, all right, these guys are real and there's something here that's working.
So you start off with 3 employees, 4 eventually.
Yeah.
When do you start hiring more people?
After we raised the first round, initially.
The 1.5 million.
Yeah, that initially we just hired software engineers.
Yeah.
So I think we hired 4. I hired 1 content person from that round. First content person started in like February of 2008. The second full-time content person was October 2008. We didn't really start building out a real editorial staff until late that time period I just referenced, where we really started to grow, is when we started to actually hire content people.
Be sure to catch live editions of Outkick the Coverage with Clay Travis weekdays at 6 a.m. Eastern, 3 a.m. Pacific.
We're talking to Dave Finocchio. I'm Clay Travis. This is the Wins and Losses podcast. I started Outkick in 2011. And my idea was, it's now 2019, you may be listening to this years after this or whenever, but we're recording in the summer of 2019. I had a section of the site called The Bullpen, right, of Outkick. And my idea was, this is going to be user-generated content. And my philosophy was, at the time, I'm 40 now, but my thought was, when I started that website, I'm roughly 32-ish, that there were a lot of people who were younger versions of me, right? Because when I came up, I had to start my own writing online. It was hard to find an audience, but I was a grinder, and I would write, and I would work hard. What I found is that talent is rare, and that talent that works is even rarer, and grit matters a great deal in everything. I think you probably found it too. And I just eventually had to stop the bullpen because, and I'm curious what you found, I had this idea that there will be a meritocracy that bubbles up of people that want to work hard and want to make their name and just want to get read, because I did it for years without really making any money while I was practicing law and everything else, with the idea being, if I'm good, I can build an audience and the money will one day follow. And what I found is, people might write one good article and they're like, hey, I expect to get paid now. I'm like, dude, you know, I wrote for years without making a dollar to prove that I was good enough to be able to do this. I bet what you found, because what I kind of admired about the Bleacher Report was what you said, the idea that we were going to create a meritocracy by people who would write and continue to write and do good quality content. Those people are rare.
I would say that I view that part of the initial thesis, I think, was, I wouldn't call it a failure is too strong. But I was more idealistic, kind of like you.
Same
you were.
Way.
I thought that the content would end up being better than it was. And people will never understand the amount of work that we did under the hood to get that user generated content, or whatever you want to call it, to the point where it actually, like, we edited all of that content. We did crazy photo deals with Getty. We had all of these, it's boring stuff, but like the amount of infrastructure that we had to create to get that content out was honestly more work than once we started paying people full time. So I had the same observation. There were people that we found through those days who did grind away and built a name for themselves that are still with us, that did really well. Like the Matt Millers, the Gary Davenports of the world. There are others. There are plenty of people who came through Bleacher Report that have gone on and had great careers other places too. But yeah, the hit rate was much smaller than I initially thought it would be.
And not only was the hit rate smaller, what I found was I'm spending a lot of time reading other people's work instead of working on my own.
Yeah, right? Well, and that's why I decided, I'm far less talented than you are from the standpoint of, sports analysis. But I figured out this, that you have to choose one path or the other. You can't do both.
Yeah, and so that was the challenge. But then what we found was we were getting a lot more attention, like you did, for sometimes things that would go up that was written by, quote unquote, it's called the bullpen, right?
Yeah.
The idea is you're not a starting pitcher. Like, you're coming in and trying to prove yourself. I guess I could have just as easily called it the minor leagues, right? But that seemed a little bit more pejorative. But the idea was find a lot of young writers who can do great original content and will continue to work, and then they can elevate themselves. Either I'll start paying them and they'll become part of the OutKick, regular universe, or I will find them, and they'll go get jobs elsewhere because other people are able to pay them more.
Yeah.
And almost no one was willing to do it. Mm. And if people who were willing to do it at a high quality level were almost non-existent. You named a few, but I bet, if you were giving a percentage, it's a tiny, tiny percentage.
I would say a lot. There were definitely hundreds of winners that came through that system. A lot of them ended up being editors or having other jobs in our organization that weren't writers. One thing I did that was really helpful early on was a lot of people wouldn't like this in our industry, but I kind of gamified the writing process, where I was like I played a ton of Halo in college, and I noticed that even when I was so sick and tired of playing Halo and I really shouldn't be playing anymore, I would keep going because every time I played a game, I would get a certain number of points, which would get me closer to having
a
better status in the game.
Uber and Lyft do now.
Yeah,
right?
Exactly.
For drivers.
Exactly.
They will gamify the job to encourage people to continue to put in hours.
That's exactly right. And so I built that system for writing for Bleacher Report. So the more reads you got on any individual article led to more points, led to you getting badges. Like, if you had an article that got 25,000 reads, that would be a really big badge, and that would help you get a better status on the site. And so we had a lot of people that got really into that and pushed and pushed and pushed. And for sure, there are a lot of people who, at the end of the day, we didn't offer jobs to, didn't offer paid gigs to, that were really upset, that put a ton of time into that. And it's something that I'm kind of two minds about. One is I feel bad that they put in a lot of work and for the expectation of getting something. And on the other hand, I think they kind of knew what they were getting into. There were never any promises made. It was a website where you were writing for free for a chance to build an audience. But there were hundreds of people that got either full time or different types of paying jobs through it. It was a mixture of experiences for people.
So you get the $1.5 million raise, which is kind of a big shot in the arm. But then you get a CEO that doesn't work out.
You said
you have that 6-month period where you go from 3 million to 10 million readers.
Yeah.
What then happens after 2010?
When do you start
thinking okay, this may be a legitimate business. Do you go raise more money? How does that process play out?
So we had raised one other round in 2008. We had this initial burst of growth, raised another $6 million. So we were growing.
And how much do you sell? So you sell 1.5, 30%, 6 million. You go, what are you selling that for then?
About another 30%.
Yeah.
So we sold 30% twice.
So 60% of the company is gone for 7.5 million roughly at that point?
That's not exactly the math, but a little bit less than that. Like, let's say about 50% of the company gone at that point. We ended up hiring another CEO in the summer of 2010, a guy named Brian Gray, who had previously run Yahoo Sports and then more recently had been running the digital arm of Fox Sports.
Yeah.
And Brian had left Fox, was an executive in residence at a VC firm in San Francisco. We just gotten to know him over the years and really liked him. And he, sports for better or worse, and I don't mean this in a demeaning way, but it's a little bit of an old boys network.
Yeah.
I think it's not as bad as it probably used to be. But Brian was just a really talented deal maker who
knew everybody.
And great CEO, but knew everybody and just helped bring credibility. I remember Brian's maybe first or second week, he and I and maybe Dave did a roadshow all over the East, New York, D.C., where maybe Chicago, wherever else we went. And he immediately introduced us to the most senior people at all of these organizations who maybe weren't taking meetings with us before. And so we, from that period until when we ended up selling the company, we were kind of like all about creating legitimacy from a brand standpoint, scaling advertising sales, growing our audience.
When did you start producing revenue like that was meaningful?
2011 was the first year we did $5 million. 2010, $5 million. 2011, $14 million. 2012, the year we sold, we did $37
million. That's fascinating to me. So that is an incredible growth rate, 5 to 14 to 37. What magic sauce were you
Nothing getting? Compared to where we are now.
But at the time, I mean, that's at 5 to 37 in 2 years. It's pretty extraordinary. What magic sauce did you hit that suddenly made your revenue explode? Like what? You're 5 years in 2011, you're doing $5 million, and then boom, suddenly you start hitting in a big time.
Yeah, the first thing to understand is for people who are listening to this who don't know that much about the business of online sports media.
Which is a lot, because this is probably the most detailed online sports media discussion that almost has been out there.
Yeah, so it's kind of a zero-sum game in terms of how the size of your audience translates to advertising dollars. And that's if you have something that really matters in a niche, like it's really important in a certain area of the country, or it's, you know, golf focused and really focused on the golf industry, you can overcome this. But if you're a general sports site, and this was probably more true back then than it is now because marketing's just a little bit more sophisticated now, you kind of had to be top five. You had to have one of the five largest audiences. So one of the reasons why we went so gung-ho on we're gonna really focus on audience growth and creating articles about all these topics that people are searching for, because we felt like we got feedback from venture capitalists that if you didn't get into that top five subset, guys, your business is worthless.
Yeah.
So like, all right, we'll deal with quality later, but right now we need to get this
big
audience.
Now.
We got to get big now. That was our strategy.
Yep.
Get big now. And so like we just jammed and got – we built up a skill set doing that I think was imitated by basically everyone else in media. I think the playbook we created is I think pretty
– Would it still work today? Like
it still works today. It's not as compelling
it's
today.
It's a more efficient market now than it was then.
That's right. There are so many people that have come in and done the same thing that if I were – I'm never going to go do this again. But if I were to go do it again, I think – like Brian Goldberg went and did the exact same thing in the women's space, and he – people gave him a lot of crap for it when he did it, but he was just better at it, so he just out-muscled everyone.
Did it surprise you sometimes that you guys were capable, as just four kids who went to high school together in the Bay Area, starting a company, could be able to make waves in the internet space in sports like you did? Like, did you ever go on to like the bigger sites and be like, I can't believe these guys... You know, because let's use ESPN as an example. Like, they are still the Goliath of the space, right?
Totally.
ESPN.com.
Yeah.
And when you guys are starting out, they have so many competitive advantages, audience advantages over you, yet you are using the data in a more sophisticated manner than they are, or do you think they were maybe crippled by their size initially? What gave your business the chance to work?
So we formed a partnership with CBSSports.com in maybe 2009 where they would link to some of our content. And
you're basically sharing traffic back and forth.
That's that type of arrangement. And I was in Fort Lauderdale where they're based, and Hat was in a meeting with their managing editor. And I asked him how he picked the stories that
are on the front page that they feature. Yeah,
that's right. And he said, you know, we assign the stories based on the writer pitching me something or me giving an assignment. I read all the stories that come in, and I put the best one on the front page. And I was with my editor in chief in the room, and we talk about this all the time. It was this epiphany moment for us. We're like, shit, this, like, what we're doing might work.
Because they are doing entirely intuition-based decision-making.
Exactly.
And you guys are looking at what people are actually reading.
This is like, this guy was a great guy, and I think was really good at his job. But
newspaper way of thinking.
That's
right.
It was a model that wasn't built for the internet. It was a model that was built for newspapers, and we were a model that was built for the internet. And it was – so to answer your question, we were just playing a different game than anybody else was playing.
It's like Moneyball for online.
Yeah. And I think I don't mean to come – for this to come across as extraordinarily arrogant. It might, but this is also something that my co-founders and I have talked a lot about over the years. There are a lot of smart people in media no doubt. But there are a lot of people that also get very entrenched in the way that they do things. There are ways that things are supposed to be done in media. And we just didn't have that background where we weren't schooled to do things in a certain way. And I think all of us are smart, but if we'd gone into other industries, we might not have been like the smartest people in our field.
Yeah.
But I think in media, we had pretty good brain power relatively. And I'm not sure that like there were that many other people who were thinking the same way that we were.
So you go from, I think you said 5 to 14 to 37 million.
Yeah.
What you get into the top five,
yeah,
and you scale that up really quickly.
And we sold our company then too. Yeah.
Or do you wish you had not sold now, looking back?
No.
Was it the right time to sell?
I think it's for so the next year after we sold, Facebook started throwing
gobs of traffic.
Just instant. Like I think my traffic went from, I went from reaching 25 million people a month to 60 million people, like really, really fast.
Yeah.
You know, like all these things we did to build audience, which were so hard and detailed and science oriented. Then Facebook comes online and all of a sudden it's like, whoosh.
Everybody exploded.
It's so, and I think we were a little better at it than most were, but it was.
What I would call that was penis pump, right?
Yeah, like, it was.
It's totally artificial. It's totally not real. But all of a sudden everybody's page views and audiences just exploded because Facebook is just such a leviathan.
Called it a lot of things. I've never called it penis pump before, but that totally works great. It was an interesting time where the one thing that kicked my butt a little bit was when Business Insider sold to Axel Springer for like $400 million. We sold for $215 million. We did really well. We were incredibly lucky. But that was the one thing where I was like, shit, like I think we've built a lot more substance than these guys have. No disrespect to their business. It's a good business. But then I look at what's happened to some of the other
Gawker sites, for instance.
That's a little bit different because of their. But like what could have happened is say we didn't sell. And we get to 2013, 2014, and VCs see our numbers, and they're like, hey, we'll write you a $100 million check at like a $500 million valuation. The way BuzzFeed,
yes,
Fox, Vice, they all did these things. And then it turned out a couple years later that it was really hard to justify those valuations. It was hard for them to scale their revenue fast enough to justify those valuations. Facebook did not end up being the ecosystem for publishers to build kind of their distribution.
And
through,
now
right?
they just dialed back.
They changed their strategy and it hurt all of those businesses. So I'm really like, we made money for everybody. I think our brand ended up with Turner did a really good job supporting Bleacher Report. That partnership was really, really good. It wasn't always easy, but it's one of the great examples of media acquisition of the last generation. So that's cool. But what if we were still out there? Like, I can't imagine, like, it would have been 15 years grinding away at this thing and, like, still haven't made any money. And, you know, maybe our company is valued at $1 billion, but nobody's willing to buy it for more than 500.
Yeah.
Like, million. That's not a good situation to be in, so I'm so glad that we didn't end up there.
Fox Sports Radio has the best sports talk lineup in the nation. Catch all of our shows at foxsportsradio.com. And within the iHeartRadio app, search FSR to listen live.
So you sell for $215 million. At the time you sold, how much had you raised?
40.
Okay. So when you sell at $215 million, I think there are a lot of people out there sitting around and they're like, man, so what happens to founders, right? So you stayed with the company for a while.
Yeah, a lot. So the other two guys were founders that were still involved with the business, left at that point.
Yeah.
I was probably managing 80% of the staff at that
yes.
point. They just had different roles. Brian left to go start another company. Dave took some time off and then started another company. I kind of kept my job. At the time, I was running like all the kind of content product stuff at the company, and I ended up taking over. Brian Gray left after 8 months or 9 months or something, so I ended up taking over the business at that point.
Yep.
Initially, when we sold, I was honestly so exhausted that I told those guys, like, I'm not staying.
You didn't have a lot left.
I was just so tired. When the sale was complete, I remember like leaving my girlfriend's apartment and I was just like, I cried tears of joy walking down the hills in San Francisco. I was just so, I put so
emotionally
much into
spent.
It. Totally. But I hung with it. they basically said, no, you're not doing a year. If we're going to sell this company, if you're going to buy this company, you have to stay for 2.5 years. And I was like, guys, I'm not doing that. They're like, okay, we're not going to buy the company. Like, okay,
yeah,
I'm gonna sack up and do this. And after getting through that initial like 6 to 9 month window, which was a little bit rough, I kept my head in the game. We continued to perform really well. There were some more fun aspects of it that came from being a part of Turner, getting promoted on TV. You get to know people that are just of a different level. I started to learn new things, and I decided to make the most of it. And really invested in that partnership.
How many employees, you may not know the exact number, but roughly, how many employees does Bleacher Report have now?
A little over 500.
A little over 500. So you guys started with 3. There's now over 500. Before you sold, I'm always curious, like what kind of salaries were you guys paying yourself? Were you living like, what kind of lifestyle you're grinding, you're working all those hours. What kind of salaries would you guys have been making by the time you sold?
I think by the time we sold, we're doing okay because we just raised $20 million on top of it. So I bet when we sold, my salary was like probably pretty close to $200,000 a year. So at that point, we're like doing great. But when we
let me pause there. $200,000. There's a lot of people listening right now. $200,000 to run a major multimedia company. It's not like you guys were just making money hand over fist as the runners, operators of this.
No, company. Probably a year before that, I bet my salary was $80,000 a year. And for the first year we did it, initially we gave ourselves stipends of $400 a month. And then after 1 month, we realized that we didn't have enough money to do it. So we didn't pay ourselves anything for, I think, close to a year.
Yep.
And then I think our salaries were $35,000 a year, and then eventually it got up to 80. But then when we raised the 20 million, I think at that point we were kind of like, hey, like we haven't been making much. Yeah, you got like, this is San Francisco, it's expensive. Like, I'm still going to live in a 400 square foot studio apartment, but like, come on.
So if you had not founded the company in San Francisco, did that matter to your company's success? You said the first 1.5 million you made was based on having some connection to Bay Area success in terms of making money. A lot of people out there listening to us right now, they try to decide, where am I going to start my company? Where am I going to live? Bleacher Report, how important was it for you guys that you were in the Bay Area? Or do you think you could have been successful anywhere starting?
I think it's a different era now. Bleacher Report now is 250 people in New York. New York is our biggest office. San Francisco.
Is that because of advertising to a large extent?
Almost the biggest part of our content team is in New York.
Yeah.
And then, the entire advertising, like the whole sales marketing
all
infrastructure,
that is
which is a giant team, is on an entire floor in New York. Media businesses almost always end up gravitating to New York as you get big because like you just have to have your sales team there. The way content and sales works today, they're pretty integrated. It's not like the old days where there's separation of church and state.
Chinese wall, so to
speak. Yeah, that just doesn't really – it's hard. It sucks. Kind of wish it existed like that, but it doesn't. So there are all sorts of things you do so that those teams can work effectively together
and
without compromising.
And to give people an example who may not know, it's like, hey, we're going to do Game of Zones, which is insanely popular. But I don't even remember. But you find somebody who wants to sponsor that.
Yeah, State Farm did it this year. Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, the content is built basically with the idea knowing it's already sold. Somebody's going to pay millions of dollars to put this thing on.
That's right.
And it's not necessarily like the Cleveland Browns come to you and they say, hey, we want a good article to be written about this. And by the way, I'm Clay Travis. This is the Wins and Losses podcast. We're talking with Dave Finocchio, who's one of the co-founders of Bleacher Report. But to give people a context on what you mean by content and partnership, like that's kind of the way things work now.
Yeah. So when they're pitching I think McDonald's did Game of Zones the year before. So State Farm this year, you know, they're negotiating an amount of money per episode. State Farm's getting essentially what's called branded content.
Yes.
So they actually do Game of Zones is an animated show, if you're not familiar with it. That's kind of like a blend between Game of Thrones and the NBA universe. But they're actually making little cartoons that might be like 10-second ads that are about State Farm versus about Game of Zones. And those get crazy distribution through us. And I think it makes State Farm look cool. And there's months of work that goes into selling a deal like that.
There's a lot of people who are listening to us right now, and they're like, I'd like to make money in sports media somehow, right? Like either as a content person or as a business person, it evolves so quickly. What advice would you give them? Like, pretend that you were 21 years old and this is the last semester where you're killing time on Notre Dame's campus and you've downloaded this podcast and you're listening and they're like, man, I'd like to be the next Dave Finocchio. What would you tell people out there listening that to you seems like an opportunity? And also keeping in mind that things move so quickly, it's hard to forecast where the business is going.
There are a couple ways to go about it. One is the traditional way is just scrap and get in the door somewhere. Like, however,
doesn't matter how much you're going to get paid.
No, it doesn't matter. It's like how much you get paid the first couple of years or even what you're doing, I don't think matters very much. I think people and their parents like way over obsess around like what job and what trajectory are you on when you're 24, 25. It doesn't matter. Like, go in somewhere, build a work ethic, like learn how to do politics inside of a bigger company or whatever, and just like start investing in yourself and learning. I think if that's the case, just like, and you want to work in sports, just go somewhere and get started and then learn more and figure out where to go next. The rule I always try to tell people, especially young people at Bleacher Report, because people usually don't ascend at Bleacher Report the way they could in the past. It's a bigger company.
Yeah,
there are more people on the depth chart ahead of you. So what I always say to people when they ask me for advice is, like, if you spend 2 or 3 years here and you feel like your learning curve is not as steep as it used to be, like you're learning slower than you used to and there isn't another opportunity for you here where you can keep learning as quickly, get the hell out of here. Go do something else. When you're young, you have to invest in yourself and just keep learning, learning, learning. If you want to be more ambitious and not go hustle for somebody else and like get inside a company, my advice on like if you want to start something in the sports space, not to be like cheesy, but you kind of need to skate to where the puck is headed, not where it is now.
Yes.
You need to have a perspective on where the industry is going and you need to make a bet on that. You're not necessarily going to be right, but like if you're gonna have the guts to do it, just go do it. And then you got a lot of people who do that. The mistake I see them make is they don't understand that opportunity needs to be big. Like, a lot of people get really into these things that they care about. You mentioned that earlier. It's like the sports editor who's doing something where they're essentially writing for their peer group versus understanding the idea you need to chase has to be something that has a chance to have mass appeal. So
you've seen that on Instagram, right? With like the House of Highlights and how quickly some of that stuff has grown. It's just insane, right?
That was my favorite thing that we've ever bought. House of Highlights was
just a kid, right? I mean, just a young guy who starts.
Omar was a senior at University of Central Florida, had the coolest voice in sports we'd ever seen. Doug Bernstein started to get me to look at it, and we that was a really, really great acquisition, and I think worked out really well for Omar too.
So what's next for you?
I'm honestly like trying to not even think about it right now.
Could you never work again now if you wanted to? Did you make enough off of Bleacher Report that you could? I mean, it's not like you're going to be like Jeff Bezos, but if you wanted to just spend the next 20 years of your life kind of
like living on a beach in Mexico or something.
Yeah. But is that something that appeals to you, or do you know?
No, I don't think so. I'm like, my attitude is more like I did this for 14 years just to put that same filter I just mentioned about learning. I kind of felt like my learning curve was flattening out. I was kind of getting bored. Still, I had the coolest job in the world, right? But I was less – like I was so used to solving tough problems and like growing quickly. And my job the last year plus or so more like managing HR issues and figuring out how to hit revenue numbers and doing P&L trade-offs and stuff. It was a great experience, but was not as exciting to me as some of the stuff in the past. So I think my plan is get away for a little while and see if I have enough energy to do something else that that I could be really proud of someday. I don't know if I'll ever do something as impactful as Bleacher Report again, but I would love to try versus my fear was if I sat around there for another 3 or 4 years, then I could just kind of be like, I'm just going to chill it for the rest of time here. And I kind of don't accomplish anything else. And I would rather, whether I succeed or fail, I'd rather give a go at trying to get inspired to do something else.
I know I might have said last question, but this is the real last question. I feel like nowadays everybody is constantly criticized, right? And you guys might have gotten an early version of that at Bleacher Report where you weren't, quote unquote, the cool kids on the internet, right?
Yeah.
And there were a lot of people who took shots at you guys. You built a business from nothing. You scaled it up all the way to several hundred million dollars to sell it. It's now got 500 employees. I feel like the internet is steeped in criticism. What would you tell people who are trying to build something about people who are going to take shots at them along the way? What have you learned?
Really early on, we figured out that, one, responding to critics, there's like literally nothing good that can come from it unless it's helping to promote unless it's in your best interest in a very direct way. There's no point. I always believed in the long-term value proposition of what we were doing. I knew that I wasn't proud as a sports, like I have, I'm a content snob in 20,000 different ways. Like I knew that the content we were producing at times wasn't content that I was always proud of, but I believed in the playbook we were running, that if we kept doing it and kept like building a business, that it would get to a point where I would be really proud of the content and the user experiences and the products. And we did that. And I'm really proud that I stuck it through and got it to the point where I built something that I'm really proud of. I think you just have to believe in yourself and like just play the long term. People are so freaking sensitive these days. You know, it's like I'm a big Warriors fan. We've just been through this Kevin Durant saga. I have a lot of respect for that guy in certain ways. And in others with like, I just like can't believe that he cares so much about
what he would create anonymous social media accounts to respond.
Yeah, I mean, I sort of get it, but at a certain point, it's like you have to realize that you are in a position in life that 99.99 whatever percent of people are never going to be in. And like it might make them feel better for 10 seconds to take a shot at you for whatever reason. It doesn't matter. Like, so I never, people said so many nasty things about us early on that I just developed thick skin and I just don't give a shit. And these days, whether it's whoever comes after us, like I'll always be pretty level headed about stuff. And I've had plenty of people. I've had Mark Cuban blow me up Portnoy or whoever it is. And I just like, I think it's funny and I just don't care. It's like all part of the game.
Kind of similar in that respect. This has been outstanding. Dave Finocchio, co-founder of Bleacher Report. We need to talk again soon. I know we're going to golf this weekend.
Yeah.
I'm looking forward to that. Appreciate you spending the time here. Good luck on the triathlon. Welcome to Nashville.
Thanks. Great to be here.
Make sure you download. Hope you enjoy them. Give me feedback. Let us know what you think. This has been the Wins and Losses podcast. I'm Clay Travis. He's Dave Finocchio. Check out Bleacher Report. We'll be back with you next week.